Hello, this is Melissa, and today is the 18th of April, 2024, and this is a bit of real history with me solo. So I won't go into the details, but I had something lined up that didn't work out, and then I had a kind of a fill-in at the very last minute, which it was a recording minor disaster, so it's just me today. For long-time listeners to Alan Watt, I wanted to let you know about Miss Effie. He did a series of conversations in 2006-2007, which he entitled Driving Miss Effie. And she was a lovely lady, older, single woman who lived in Louisiana, who'd had a really interesting life. She'd been a longshoreman, done all kinds of not typically female things, including building her own home, you know, teaching herself how to do framing. And of course she had help, but, you know, she built a little home. And last fall, when I received my property tax bill and saw how much it had increased, one of the first things that I thought about was Alan's conversation with Miss Effie, and the fact that you don't, you know, if you're paying taxes on something, then you don't really own it. The house can be taken away from you. And so at that time, I think it was back in October, I replayed one of their conversations as a redux. And I got to thinking about her and wondered if she was still alive. And I suspected that she was not. But I got into a little bit of an online search, and I saw one of those, like, my life kind of people searches, that she was 98 years old, and it, you know, showed her as still being alive. So when I saw that, the first thing that I did was call her. And the phone number that I had for her was no longer in operation. So I thought, well, you've got her nephew's phone number, call the nephew. And that was no longer in operation. I also had her address, her home address, and I looked that up online just out of curiosity to see if it was still associated with her. And sure enough, it said, you know, the known tenants or residents of the place were Effie and her nephew. So since I couldn't reach them by phone, I wrote a letter. And I wrote it, you know, to her and or the nephew. Sent it to the home address. And, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks later, that was returned to me. And so I took the returned letter and I put it in another envelope and I had it delivered to general delivery. I think what you're going to get by the time I finish this little story is the idea, you're going to have a better idea of, I don't like to label it obsessive, but I'm thorough. When I get something in my head, I like to be thorough about it. So I mailed a letter to general delivery, and that was returned. Then I decided, well, what better way to pass my afternoon than to call every nursing home, long care facility in about a 30-mile radius of where she lives and just see if she's there. Couldn't find her that way. And finally, I thought, I called the Chamber of Commerce, the city, you know, anything that I could think of. Do you know this woman? Everything was a no, no, no. But there she's still listed as owning that house. So I finally called the sheriff or the local police, whoever covered the greater area. And I said, have you come across this name or these names, her and her nephew, in the course of your work? No, we haven't, blah, blah, blah. And she was very nice and helpful. And she said, I would be happy to send a patrol car out to the house and see if anybody is there or if they're okay, you know, the wellness check or this, you know. And at that point, I stopped. I gave up because I felt like my invasion of privacy had gone far enough. So I did not find Miss Effie, as far as I know. She is still living. And I thought that was pretty neat. And according to the records that I found online, she turned 99 on the 6th of April. So to Miss Effie, wherever she is, a woman of wisdom, common sense, very interesting kind of living real history that Alan did with her. That's Miss Effie. Now, one of the things, changing gears here, that Alan and I did was watch movies. Probably a lot of them now that I think about it. Some documentaries, but lots and lots of just entertainment movies. And if I think back to all of the years that we were together, it was a massive pile of movies that we saw, sometimes watching some of them two or three times. Now, one of the reasons why is because if you have, you know, hard labor, you're doing firewood, you're cooking, you're cleaning up, you're whatever it is that you're doing. And in his case, it was a lot of research and reading of a certain type of news and the research that would go along with that. And your brain gets tired and it doesn't want necessarily to be educated all of the time. Sometimes it just wants a break. And one way of taking a break, giving your mind a break, of course, is you just go outside and look at the stars. But on a buggy night, if you don't have your screen tent up, you don't really want to be doing that. Or you go for a walk, take the dog for a walk. But sometimes the right way to switch gears and give your brain a change of lanes is just watching a movie. And what I find now on my own is that most of the time what happens with me is I sit in front of the television for about 20 minutes and just channel surf. I find it educational, maybe a little bit relaxing, but ultimately I give up and I get bored and I go do something else because I haven't found anything that I want to waste an hour and a half or two of my life on. But last night, I quickly settled on a movie just because I wanted to check out that way. I didn't want to channel surf, and I didn't want to waste my time looking. So, Spinning Man. That was the movie from 2018. And it starred Guy Pearce as a professor of the philosophy of linguistics. And Minnie Driver played his wife and the mother of his two children. And Pierce Brosnan played a detective who is investigating the disappearance of a teenage girl. And things begin to point to Guy Pearce as a suspect in this case. And what we find out is that this history that he has with young girls is hinted at until it builds, it grows, and then you start to see the scenes in his own mind where he appears to be interested in a younger girl, attracted to her, almost to the point of kind of obsessive thinking and visualization in his mind. So he was a professor of the philosophy of linguistics, and something that he was kind of arrogantly proud of. And he would talk about, he'd play word games a lot. He played word games with his wife that drove her crazy. When the detective first came around, it was kind of word game there, and couldn't just cooperate or answer a simple yes or no. It was always, what does that word mean? Did they use the word that they really meant to use? That kind of thing. And at one point, he came into the classroom before the class began, and he put a chair up against the wall below the whiteboard, the chalkboard, the blackboard, whatever. And he wrote on the blackboard, "Prove that this chair exists." I'll come back to that movie in a minute. What it got me thinking about after I finished watching it was Theodore Adorno and the role that he played in critiquing culture, and then you could go on and say culture creation. And I wasn't exactly sure what I was looking for when I started digging around in his writing this morning, mostly online. You know, he wrote a lot of essays. I didn't have what I wanted, like in paper form, so I was just digging. And I have to tell you that I was pleased. I was pleased when I did a general metadata search on Internet Archive for Theodore Adorno. And amongst the first 20 items that came up were about a dozen of Alan Watt audios talking about Theodore Adorno. And I thought, oh, that's really cool. But I had to refine my search a little bit just to try to get what was in my mind. I wanted to find some kind of documentation in his own writing for what I was kind of thinking about. And that was that some years back, I read some Theodore Adorno, and I remember at one point, there were a couple of things that I read. The first was something that I couldn't find today, but he was criticizing the paucity or the impoverishment of the English language, that it was not a good language for philosophy. It wasn't a good language for much of anything except possibly business, because you just couldn't convey the ideas that you had in your head, particularly if you were a philosophical thinker and you wanted to convey lots of complex ideas and interrelationships, English was not satisfying as a language. But I also remembered that years ago when I was reading something by him, I realized after about a page and a half of reading at a certain section that page and a half was one sentence. And that just astonished me. I mean, I knew that it was kind of hard for me to follow, and but I realized that that's one sentence that has taken him, I didn't count the words, but, you know, a page and a half to get it across. Theodore Adorno was German. He was from Germany. And again, longtime listeners will know who he was, but he was a philosopher, a musicologist, and a social theorist. And he was a leading member of the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory that had started in Germany. And a lot of those thinkers and academics that were involved with that came over to the U.S. after World War II, and names that you might be familiar with include Max Horkheimer and Eric Fromm and Herbert Marcuse, and most certainly, the most famous piece of work that they did, which upon further investigation turned out to have some government support in the writing of it, was a book entitled, or a study that got turned into a book, called The Authoritarian Personality. And that was from 1950. And a crude summary is that something about the Western way of thinking and having families, that the patriarchal system, the church, and so forth, particularly the U.S., had created a mind that this school described as authoritarian, or a place where an authoritarian personality could be raised. In other words, The idea is, how can we avoid another Hitler? And I won't jump into the Frankfurt School deep at all, other than to say that their work was broad and far-reaching, and I am of the opinion that it was incredibly, that the overall result of the body of work done by the Frankfurt School was destructive to culture. So I'm leaving that at that. That Theodor Adorno was German. And for Germans who might be listening to this, or German-speaking people, I mean absolutely no offense by where I'm going next. I just found it humorous. I already told you that I read a translation into English, and I found myself reading a sentence that was a page and a half. And I remembered at that time that I read Adorno, that years before I had read a humorous piece by Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, that was known as Mark Twain, entitled The Awful German Language. And I reread that then because it was more entertaining to me than Adorno. And I'm just going to read you just a tiny few little excerpts here and there. I'll put the link up and you can read it yourself. It's quite entertaining. He starts out by saying, he gives a quote from Proverbs, "A little learning makes the whole world kin." And I believe that's Proverbs 32:7. So if you have just a little bit of learning, then the whole world is your kin, your relative, your family, your tribe. He said, "I went often to look at the collection of curiosities in Heidelberg Castle, and one day I surprised the keeper of it with my German. I spoke entirely in that language. He was greatly interested, and after I had talked a while, he said my German was very rare, possibly a unique, and wanted to add it to his museum. If he had known what it cost me to acquire my art, he would have also known that it would break any collector to buy it. Harris and I had been hard at work on our German during several weeks at that time, and although we had made good progress, it had been accomplished under great difficulty and annoyance, for three of our teachers had died in the meantime. A person who has not studied German can form no idea of what a perplexing language it is. Surely, there is not another language that is so slipshod and systemless and so slippery and elusive to the grasp. One is washed about in it, hither and thither in the most helpless way, and when at last he thinks he has captured a rule which offers firm ground to take a rest on, amid the general rage and turmoil of the 10 parts of speech, he turns over the page and reads, 'Let the pupil make careful note of the following exceptions.' He runs his eye down and finds that there are more exceptions to the rule than instances of it. So overboard he goes again to hunt for another Ararat and find another quicksand. Such has been and continues to be my experience. Every time I think I have got one of these four confusing cases where I am master of it, a seemingly insignificant preposition or preposition intrudes itself into my sentence, clothed with an awful and unsuspected power, and crumbles the ground from under me." He goes on to give a lot of examples, and I'm just scrolling down. It's not a very long essay, and I'll post a link where you can find it. But I just want to read you a couple of humorous things here. He said, "Every noun has a gender, and there is no sense or system in the distribution. So the gender of each must be learned separately and by heart. There is no other way. To do this, one has to have a memory like a memorandum book. In German, a young lady has no sex, while a turnip has. Think what overwrought reverence that shows for the turnip and what callous disrespect for the girl. See how it looks in print. I translate this from a conversation in one of the best of the German Sunday school books. Gretchen said, Wilhelm, where is the turnip? Wilhelm replied, She has gone to the kitchen. Gretchen says, Where is the accomplished and beautiful English maiden? And Wilhelm answers, It has gone to the opera. To continue with the German genders, a tree is male, its buds are female, its leaves are neuter. Horses are sexless, dogs are male, cats are female, tomcats included. Of course, a person's mouth, neck, bosom, elbows, fingers, nails, feet, and body are of the male sex. And his head is male or neuter, according to the word selected to signify it, and not according to the sex of the individual who wears it. For in Germany, all the women, either male heads or sexless ones, a person's nose, lips, shoulders, breast, heads, and toes are of the female sex, and his hair, ears, eyes, chin, legs, knees, heart, and conscience haven't any sex at all. The inventor of the language probably got what he knew about a conscience from hearsay. So, it's entertaining if you like that kind of thing, and I've always enjoyed a bit of Mark Twain over the course of my life. So there's that. And then separately, I'll post this one too. There is a speech that Twain delivered. So that was called The Awful German Language. Then there is a speech entitled The Horrors of the German Language. And this he delivered to the Vienna Press Club in November of 1897. And it, too, is quite humorous. It's shorter. The Horrors of the German Language is shorter than The Awful German Language. And what he does here is he delivers a speech in English on the right, in German on the right-hand column, and on the left he translates it into English. And it's just so awful and funny. He said, his translation says, The German language speak I not good, but have numerous connoisseurs me assured that I her write like an angel. Maybe, I know not. Have till now no acquaintance with the angels had, that comes later, when it the dear God please, it has no hurry. Since long, my gentlemen, have I the passionate longing nursed a speech on German to hold, but one has me not permitted. Men who no feeling for the art had laid me ever hindrance in the way and made me not my desire, sometimes by excuses, often by force. Always said these men to me, Keep you still, your highness, silence, for God's sake, seek another way and means yourself obnoxious to make. So it goes on for a couple of pages, and this is Mark Twain mocking the incredible difficulty of the German language and the fact that it simply makes no sense to one trying to learn it. In another place, I found him saying that English should be able to be mastered by a diligent and studious person in about 30 hours. French might take 30 days. German would take 30 years to master. Well, 30 years to get, but maybe still not master. So that was his humor, and I thought it was a good comeback to the slight that Adorno had made about the English language. The detective is zeroing in on Guy Pearce, the professor of the philosophy of linguistics, as the suspect. And at this point, he has found a strand of the missing girl's hair in the back seat of the car, and a lip gloss belonging to her, possibly, was discovered by his daughter and given to the mother. So things are kind of closing in on him. And what we can see, it's a little bit of a ripoff on Guy Pearce's performance in the movie Memento, that he's having memory difficulties. the professor is visited one day after his class, when he's getting ready for the class, and he's written this on the board: please prove that this chair exists. He got into the wordplay with the detective there on it. And finally, a few minutes later, they go back to proving that the chair exists. And it's a retort of, during the conversation. The professor said, "Well, then, prove that that chair exists." And the detective glanced over where we knew that he'd already acknowledged that the chair exists. He glanced over there, and he looked back at the professor and said, "What chair?" To me, that kind of summed up the torturous games that are played around language and how language is used to control us. It's very seldom used to illuminate things. It's very seldom actually used for the purposes that we're told that it is. And I thought about something that Alan wrote in the Cutting Through. I think it's in volume 1, page 62 here. He said, "Those who control the world and our destiny have unlimited access to archives and knowledge, funding and publishing, education, specialization, goal formation, and implementation. Even the Vatican has an official department of propaganda," as he writes, Alan writes, "propaganda. Words and the science which created words was held in the highest esteem by ancient priesthoods. Language learning is innate in young children. Ideas are conveyed in words. Perverts took over this science long ago. Words shape our opinions. Coupled with emotive human gestures, we are motivated to tears, war, love, hate, etc. The caliphs," and that's, he says parenthetically, "Persian kings or magi of Hollywood use this ancient art to perfection. They live in California. All religions appear to have been created by Persian magi. Every religion has an accompanying secret doctrine, the same secret doctrine. This is not speculation nor assumption, but is the conclusion reached after extensive research." Here is just a little example of Adorno's tortured writing. This is from an essay entitled "Culture, Industry, Enlightenment as Mass Deception." This appears, I only found a chapter 2 without reference to what it was in, so apologies for that. But the chapter appears to be about Theodore Adorno and Max Horkheimer, "The Culture, Industry, Enlightenment as Mass Deception." Now, had I had more time today, I would have sourced that better, but I just want to scroll down here and find, and this is actually Adorno's writing on page 35 of that chapter 2. "Real life is becoming indistinguishable from the movies. The sound film, far surpassing the theater of illusion, leaves no room for imagination." I should say, actually, I'll go back and reread that. This won't be the best example of his torturous writing. It will deliver another point, and I'll try to find some real torture for you in a minute. "Real life is becoming indistinguishable from the movies. The sound film, far surpassing the theater of illusion, leaves no room for imagination or reflection on the part of the audience, who are unable to respond within the structure of the film, yet deviate from its precise detail without losing the thread of the story. Hence, the film forces its victims to equate it directly with reality. The stunting of the mass media consumers' powers of imagination and spontaneity does not have to be traced back to any psychological mechanisms. He must ascribe the loss of those attributes to the objective nature of the products themselves, especially to the most characteristic of them, the sound film. They are so designed that quickness, powers of observation, and experience are undeniably needed to apprehend them at all. Yet sustained thought is out of the question if the spectator is not to miss the relentless rush of facts. Even though the effort required for his response is semi-automatic, no scope is left for the imagination. Those who are so absorbed by the world of the movie, by its images, gestures, and words, that they are unable to supply what really makes it a world, do not have to dwell on particular points of its mechanics during a screening. All the other films and products of the entertainment industry, which they have seen, have taught them what to expect. They react automatically. The might of industrial society is lodged in men's minds. The entertainment's manufacturers know that their products will be consumed with alertness even when the consumer is distraught, for each of them is a model of the huge economic machinery which has always sustained the masses, whether at work or at leisure, which is akin to work. The culture industry as a whole has molded men as a type unfailingly reproduced in every product. All the agents of this process, from the producer to the women's clubs, take good care that the simple reproduction of this mental state is not nuanced or extended in any way. Now, a little bit of a backstory here on Adorno is that, first of all, he may not be that well known to people, but within academic circles and people who study philosophy, he is often referred to as one of the great or influential philosophers of the 20th century. But one of the interesting things about the Frankfurt School and critical social critique that they were engaged in was that so much of what they were doing came by a criticism of capitalism. And Adorno starts from the position that the entertainment industry is a capitalistic endeavor. He holds up real, what he'd call true art. True art is music or painting and so forth. That is true art. The artisan, the individual who is engaged in a creative process. But the mass industry of the film business, this is capitalism at its worst, according to Adorno. So he is criticizing something that in his own way he would be involved in, which is the culture industry. But I say rubbish to that. Rubbish. Because other than a person, you know, doodling or carving a piece of wood where there is no intended audience, where there is no expected sale of the product or work of art, can you have something that could be considered to be a true expression of an individual for no other reason than expressing it? Because what he might hold up as high art, music for instance, involves industry. The instruments have to be produced. Oh yeah, way back when, I suppose they were, you know, handcrafted. But they're even in a handcrafting of an instrument, you're looking at an industrial operation. If you're thinking about the manufacture of the instruments that you would need for one symphony in 1750. Same can be said about ballet. Same can be said even about painting, which is, you know, you think of the artist alone in his studio, possibly with a model, possibly just thinking about something that he saw in nature and then making the painting. But we wouldn't even know about these artists who we're told are individuals if someone had not deemed their work to be worthwhile, and then it was sold, and if it's sold, there's a demand for it, and the demand is part of fashion, which is the created, this is what is fashionable, this is what is art. So I'm sure linguistically that Theodore Adorno could run circles around me, but at the heart of what he's saying, is rubbish. And another thing that he said is that, let me see if I can find that I downloaded here. It was a little essay that he wrote. This is, again, it's from a compilation, a book here, about different things, but we're going to eventually get into something that Adorno wrote entitled Theses on the Language of the Philosopher. So Adorno said, all philosophical critique is today possible as the critique of language. So he's talking about the importance of language and the fact that you cannot even have a philosophical discussion if you have not mastered language. So this is what Adorno writes in this essay, Theses on the Language of the Philosopher. The distinction between form and content in philosophical language is not a disjunction in an eternity without history. Now, I just gotta say, I mean, I can't bear it. I can't bear the kind of writing that just isn't straightforward. So like, oh, okay, I get it. You know, right away, I get it. It belongs, he said, specifically to idealist thought and corresponds to the idealist distinction between form and content of knowledge. It is based on the view that concepts and with them words are abbreviations of a multiplicity of characteristics whose unity is constituted solely by consciousness. Now, I'm skipping down. He describes in this first point, in this first paragraph, thinking being dependent upon language, upon the words. He said, philosophical language, which intends truth, knows no signa. Through language, history wins a share of truth. So again, through language, history wins a share of truth. Words are never merely signs of what is thought under them, but rather history erupts into words, establishing their truth hyphen character. The share of history in the word unfailingly determines the choice of every word, because history and truth meet in the word. Now, even though I cannot stand his writing, this is a very interesting little bit here for a variety of reasons. Because in his writing, there's not truth. There's truth hyphen character. So kind of like a truth. So history then shapes the word. Okay, let me read that again here. The share of history in the word unfailingly determines the choice of every word, because history and truth meet in the word. And that reminded me of something that Carol Quigley said in Tragedy and Hope when he was talking about, you know, people used to think that there was an agreed upon view of history. Specifically, he was talking about religion, but why these things can't be generally or unanimously accepted is that we are, according to Quigley, coming upon truth in real time, which again is a very deceptive thing to say. Quigley writes in Tragedy and Hope, my volume of it is about page 833, he said, it should be evident by now that truth is a remote goal which man approaches by walking, a process in which one foot is always behind the other. The true and final goal of man as we know him must be a synthesis of varied elements, because man is so obviously a creature of varied nature, and our imperfect vision, both of man's nature and of the universe in which he operates, must be a consensus of divergent points of view. So that was something that struck me that earlier on at the beginning of the book, he talks about religion, and it's a consensus. These are historians. I mean, Adorno more a philosopher, but Quigley a historian, who are saying truth is consensus. And Adorno writing the word establishes its truth / character. The share of history in the word unfailingly determines the choice of every word, because history and truth meet in the word. Well, who writes history? Right? The victors, the conquerors. So according to Adorno, a word and its truth and the character of the word, the validity of the word comes from its share of history. So again, like I say, these are rather torturous things. And what fascinated me about the movie Spinning Man was the torturous wordplay. What we're looking at, what the director and the screenwriter did not ever touch on, was what else might impact memory. What you see by the conclusion of the film is that this professor has played so many tricks with words, so many mind games perhaps with his wife and with everyone around him, including his own students, that he can no longer distinguish which version of his memory is correct. And what we finally learn is that he is in this town as a professor at this university because he and his family had to leave the town where they were earlier because of a scandal. And he tells the scandal two ways. The first version of the story is that he had an inappropriate relationship with a young student. Is it legal? Yes. We are, you know, told that she was 18. So it's legal. But it's inappropriate because there's a huge age difference. He's in a position of authority as her teacher, and he's a married man. So this is one version of the story. The parents were outraged. They wanted him driven from the town, and he had to leave that university and get a job at another university. In that version of the story, he did not have an affair with the young student. It was proximity between them and perhaps her fantasies, etc., etc. But he remembers that he refrained from this inappropriate relationship. But he confesses to the detective there's another version of the story which he believes to be equally true. And that is that he did have an affair with the young woman. What you see in flashbacks and the visual depiction of his fantasies is that this is continuing on. So on the one hand, we're told by the director and the screenwriter and the actors and the way they put this across that he's confused and he has memory problems because of word games. He's told himself different versions of the story. He's put words in his head that have given him different realities. But the one thing that was never touched on at all in the screenplay or by the director or did not come out at all were two things that I was very struck by. The first was the use of alcohol. In many scenes, we saw the character drinking. And I wondered, is this alcohol consumption just so normalized now that people just come home from work and they have a beer or they have a glass of wine or they go out and they have a cocktail? Is this so normalized now? And certainly in other pieces of visual fiction that I've seen, I can see that, yes, it is you know, the consumption of a lot of alcohol is normalized, and it's something that people do, the social lubricant. But that isn't touched on at all, and I found that to be an important oversight, because alcohol impairs memory. Even when one doesn't drink to blackout, it impairs your memory. And the second thing that was not touched on was the impact that obsession and addiction might have on one's memory. And I was thinking about the way in which they conveyed his obsession. And it was interesting because there wasn't nudity in the film. There was some implied sex, and there were some scenes of sexual encounters, but they were not shown graphically or with nudity. But what was conveyed in the film was how he saw young women with whom he interacted with, whether it was a student or the girl who went missing or the girl who was the cashier at the hardware store. He actually saw them in what looked to me like Picasso painting of a face. I don't know that the director and the cinematographer meant to put that across, but what it was the objectification of the young girl. And not so much the body, but the face. In the face was symbolized youth. And what he saw might be just one eye, or the close-up of the eyebrow, or zooming in on the skin and seeing the unblemished, clear complexion that only a young girl between the age of, say, 14 and 20 is going to have. Or the lips. There's not one wrinkle, one whistle or smile wrinkle there. It's just lips and their youthfulness and pure sexuality. That's what he saw. But what I kept thinking in these scenes in his flashbacks, because the flashbacks couldn't even accurately be called flashbacks. At this point, we don't know, as an audience, we have been taken on a ride, so we don't know what happened and what he imagines happened and what he thinks might have happened, because the word games have been coming at us hard and fast since the beginning of the film. But I thought about obsession and addiction in any form. So if you have something that you're obsessed with that you have to have, then that can take over. It can color your whole outlook. It can color everything about you until you can't actually distinguish any longer important parts of reality. And why? Because you've checked out. You're daydreaming or fantasizing, or you've paused, you've taken a break from reality in order to allow into your head the images of non-reality. Because even a memory is not reality. And so I did a little bit of diving in this morning into the world of what studies have been done on what happens to the human mind in regards to memory when sexual addiction or obsessive behavior around sexuality is in play. And sure enough, not at all to my surprise, but sure enough, there are quite a few different studies that show that sexual addicts might lose track of time. Here's just the title of one from 2020. Sexual cues alter working memory performance and brain processing in men with compulsive sexual behavior. So they show that pornographic pictures affect the working memory. Patients with compulsive sexual behavior show slowed reaction times when presented with pornographic distractors. that varies also over their consumption. And I just went further in my thinking that it wouldn't necessarily have to be the consumption of pornography, but it would slow your reaction time and alter your memory performance just based on how many times you had indulged in a sexual fantasy. So this isn't a temperance sin kind of talk. Where I was going in my head with this was how, as a culture, especially when it's compared to what Adorno had to say about the effects of the film industry, the movie industry, on men and women, on their brains, on how they think. In other words, he's showing that this visual imagery changes how you think. It doesn't give you time to reflect. You're caught up in, you've got to train your mind to take in this quick succession of visual cues. And so there's no room in there for your rational brain to interject and go, oh, wait a minute, what am I being downloaded with? Wait a minute, what am I seeing here? And Alan talked about that a lot too, is that in, you know, during the process of being entertained, we are also being downloaded with new ideas and new ways of behavior. And the entertainment that we are given, the movies that we are given, the advertising that we're given, what we see in a television program, it fails to deliver. Alan was always fond of pointing out that you know, the toothpaste ad is constructed in such a way that you have the feeling that if you have that brand of toothpaste, you're going to get this orgasmic pleasure that you see is delivered in the ad. It doesn't deliver, and it's that way with everything, you know. The car, the dress, the hair color, the toothpaste, all of this is going to deliver orgasmic pleasure. And of course, that can't be delivered. That is impossible. So thinking about the way that the obsession or the addiction could harm, even greatly damage memory, made me think again about Adorno's writing, about the fact that the Hollywood industry and the films that it produces, they never satisfy. They bring up, he even writes, the pornographic, which he says is even neutered of any sexuality. I think the words that he uses are, again, he's defending what he calls high art. He said it's ascetic and unashamed, like if you were seeing a naked statue or something, I guess, you know, it's unashamed. The culture industry is pornographic and prudish. Love is downgraded to romance. And after the descent, much is permitted, even license. As a marketable specialty has its quota bearing the trade description daring. The mass production of the sexual automatically achieves its repression. And that's an interesting thought there. What it fails to deliver, what it does, is it creates a type of pornography. Even in the things that you can't call purely pornographic, it's a constant use of sex and sexual imagery and sexual desire and sexual longing, and it doesn't deliver. It cannot deliver. And so what you have, what I thought when I saw that movie, Spinning Man, and at the very, very end of the movie, they show the hamster on the wheel. So you finally understand what the title's about. And I thought, that's what they have done to us as a worldwide standardized culture. They have created the craving of the addict, the compulsions and the obsessions of the addict. We are trauma bonded to our abusers. Never satisfied, never satisfied, and always potentially in a disassociative state from reality. It's a pretty amazing sciences at work always. Now, here is something to think about. Early on when I met Alan and we were talking about thinking, he told me that he thought in pictures. He thought in images. And I had never heard someone describe their thinking process that way, but since then I've talked to other people, primarily people who have some artistic training or bent, have described that their thinking process too is visual. It's in images. And there is a bit of a puzzler there, because we know how effective culture has been changed through image. And I think one of the early movies that sort of revealed this process was the German film Der Golem. I think there ended up being two or three installments of it, but there is at least one from, I don't know, I'm going to take a guess here, I'm not looking at it, but maybe around 1919, that shows the creation of Der Golem, which is the slave, the perfect slave made out of clay. Very interesting, but what you see in that film is that the Magi, the Hollywood Magi, the Caliphs, and I mean, Hollywood was fairly young at that time, but the Caliphs were around. And they revealed the method in that movie that when they showed you the conjuring of the film onto the screen and how people were simply blown away, they'd never seen anything like it. And we now take it for granted that, you know, there's movies have been around all of our lifetimes and our parents and our grandparents, etc. We take it for granted. But you're still looking at high science. So Adorno can bemoan that as a social critic. He can bewail that. But he would also know that we're looking at high science. It may not be the art. It may not be art in service of anti-capitalism that Adorno wanted it to be, but you're looking at high sciences at work on the human brain. And it, again, I go back to something that I touched on in last week's Redux, which was being reminded of the Society for Psychical Research and what they were studying, the phenomenon, the psychic and paranormal phenomenon. And it said that areas of study that they were working on included hypnotism and disassociation. And those are actually two related things, and they were seen as being related. This is just really a quick little description from Wiki on disassociation. It said that disassociation is a concept that has been developed, okay? A concept that has been developed over time, and which concerns a wide array of experiences ranging from a mild emotional detachment from the immediate surroundings to a more severe disassociation or severe disconnection from physical and emotional experiences. The major characteristic of all disassociative phenomena involves a detachment from reality, rather than a false perception of reality, as in psychosis. The phenomena are diagnosable under DSM-5 as a group of disorders, as well as a symptom of other disorders through various diagnostic tools. Its cause is believed to be related to neurobiological mechanisms, trauma, anxiety, and psychoactive drugs. Research has further related it to suggestibility and hypnosis, and it is inversely related to mindfulness, which is a potential treatment. And I'll just say, my two cents on mindfulness is that, you know, unfortunately, the way it's presented to us, there's a close connection there with meditation and meditative states, which again can take you back into suggestibility and hypnosis. But there you go. For so long, they have been studying suggestibility and disassociation. And I still ask that question that I was asking on Sunday, why? And what I saw portrayed in the movie when I saw this fictional character be unable to ascertain for himself even an approximation of the memory, because we all know that memory is faulty. But he, when faced with two radically different recollections of events, simply couldn't arrive at either one as being the truth. And I think for people who, you know, for the victors who write the history, studied like rats in a lab, as we have been, the most studied species on the planet, as Alan constantly reminded us, that the movie industry plays a big role in hypnotism and states of disassociation. So I read a little bit on page 35 about what Adorno said about real life becoming indistinguishable from the movies. And I'm going to scroll down to that same, in that same essay, to page 38. And he is talking about the failure of art, again, to achieve what he thinks it needs to achieve. So a little bit on page 37 before what I get there. If somebody who can write a sentence that takes a page and a half, it's kind of hard to figure out where to break in. But I'll try. That factor in a work of art which enables it to transcend reality certainly cannot be detached from style. But it does not consist of the harmony actually realized, of any doubtful unity of form and content within and without, of individual and society. It is to be found in those features in which discrepancy appears, in the necessary failing, the necessary failure of the passionate striving for identity. Instead of exposing itself to this failure, in which the style of the great work of art has always achieved self-negation, the inferior work has always relied on its similarity with others, on a surrogate identity. And I'm going to say here that sometimes even monsters in service of culture creation hit upon something truthful and interesting, and that one thing in that sentence is the failure of the passionate striving for identity. Is this not what the conscious and awakened mind needs to be doing, is seeking its separation and individuality from the system? But of course, someone like Adorno knows the absolute impossibility of such. He goes on to write, in the culture industry, this imitation finally becomes absolute. Having ceased to be anything but style, it reveals the latter's secret: obedience to the social hierarchy. And here we get to the whole point of Adorno and everything that he was about. He hated the film industry as it existed at that time, because he felt that it was making people conformist. And he was quite right. But what he thought it needed to do was make us revolutionary, right? Like little communist revolutionaries. So he bewailed the obedience to the social hierarchy. Skipping a little bit. The culture industry perpetually cheats its consumers of what it perpetually promises. The promissory note, which, with its plots and staging, it draws on pleasure, is endlessly prolonged. The promise, which is actually all the spectacle consists of, is illusory. All it actually confirms is that the real point will never be reached, that the diner must be satisfied with the menu. It's a good paragraph there. I think I've gone on long enough, and I'm going to stop. I'll post a link to this little bit on the culture industry enlightenment as mass deception, and you can go find the rest of that on page 38. It isn't just linguistic minimalism that is the problem, as Orwell was writing. You know, they won't have someone to revolt against the system because they will not be able to find the words to do so. But it isn't just the minimalism, but the fact that the words have been played with so long and the meaning has been stripped from the words by the masters, that they no longer even contain the symbol that they used to. And Adorno knew this, and all of the wordsmiths of his ilk, who know what words are really there for, they know this too. And I think that one of the things, and again this came up in Sunday's Redux, one of Alan's prescriptions would be nonlinear thinking. Jump from here to there, and there to here, and over yonder in your mind. Certainly, don't allow your thinking to be shaped by a school of thought or a body of work. I think in the lineup upcoming there, I'll be speaking with someone from Brazil. And actually, I may end up with three in a row from Canada. That's just the way that it's looking to be lined up. But a lot of interesting people to speak with upcoming, and apologies that you were forced to listen to me flying solo with something that obsessed my thinking. Take care and have a good week. Thank you.